Hi, ladies, and welcome to the Story Night podcast. I'm Jessica Campbell, and stories are my passion. It's my honor to host this podcast where real women share real stories of real hope. Each episode features one woman sharing her personal story with you. Too often, we fall into the traps of comparison and judgment, but what if we took the time to hear each other's real stories? Let's remember that we all have a story, and our stories matter. We're so glad you've joined us on this podcast journey. May you find hope and encouragement in this episode's story. Hi, ladies, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Story Night podcast. If this is your first time finding us, welcome. We are so glad you're here. It's a great idea to check out episode one, where we talk all about the history and purpose and vision of Story Night. And if you've been listening for a while, you already know we get to talk with women all over our community and hear stories that are so diverse. Some of them are lighthearted and some of them are heavy. And we are going to embark on a two-part story that starts with this episode with my precious new friend, Nancy. And I'm so glad that you're here, Nancy. Thank you for being willing to share this. None of this is easy to share, but you definitely have a heart to care for women and remind them that they are not alone. And that is the heart of Story Night. So before we dive into your story, would you take a quick moment and just introduce yourself to the listeners, just about who you are in your life today?
Okay. My name is Nancy Pitts, and I am retired, living in McMinnville and loving it here.
And you went through a lot of places before you landed in McMinnville. So right. That's a little bit of the story, but let's start at the beginning. Where did your story begin? Where were you born?
I was born in the LA area, but we moved shortly to Central California to a small farm. I have a sister who's 4.5 years older than I am, and had good mom and dad. My mom was very spunky and compassionate and wise. My dad was very introverted and insecure, but very compassionate. When I was sick, very sick, he would sit beside my bed all night. And that sounds all wonderful, but both of my parents had a favorite child, and I happened to be my mom's, and my sister was my dad's, and it was very obvious. And that set me up for looking to fix what was wrong in my childhood. And I was thinking about that this morning, that the guys I dated in high school, it was pretty normal. When I got to college, it was a very small college in Portland, and there was one guy in the college that everybody was interested in because he was aloof and unavailable. And
hard to get.
Yeah. So that kind of gives you a challenge. Like, my dad was hard to get his attention. And this guy whose name is Gene, he was the opposite of my dad, very bold, very out there, funny, adventurous. Spent a summer logging in Alaska, middle of his senior year, took off with a friend to hitchhike across the U.S., take a freighter across to Europe and hitchhike across Europe. So, you know, somebody that you just kind of thought, that's an interesting guy. During the years in college, I was with him for a year in college, and when I liked him, he didn't like me, back and forth for 5 years. And during that time, I was engaged to two other guys.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, when I'd get engaged, then he'd come back, and he didn't really want to lose me, but he didn't want me either. And it finally...
So you'd break off an engagement and kind of circle back to Gene.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And after college, I was teaching Job Corps in Hawaii, and he was in seminary in Kentucky and decided to come and work in Hawaii. And so we kind of rekindled our relationship then. And I just said, you know, you have to make up your mind. He had a girlfriend in Kentucky who he was very attracted to, but he, you know, we had a long history, and he showed me a pro and con list for both of us.
Wow.
And I edged.
How romantic.
No, it's so fun. And so I edged her out a little bit because he thought I'd make a better preacher's wife. I had more skills that he needed if he was going to be a preacher. So when he left to go back to seminary, I gave him an ultimatum. If he didn't call me by his birthday, it was done over completely, never, never again. And so he did call me as late as he could on his birthday. He had had a fever. He wasn't feeling good. And he said, "Okay, let's get engaged." And I said, it wasn't like, "I love you. Will you marry me?" It's like, okay, kind of like he gave up. Reluctantly coming into engagement, marriage, everything. And at the end, I said, "Well, when do you want to get married?" And he said, "It doesn't matter to me as long as it doesn't interfere with hunting season." So, you have to get your priorities straight.
Sure. Now, listening to you tell the story now, so many years later, I mean, you can hear it in your voice that you see the red flags, but
Yeah.
at the time, did you see them?
No, because I just knew that if I loved him enough, he would turn around and love me back. You just work hard and you just keep loving. And also, I believe that marriage changes people for the better because my dad was a drinker, smoker, carouser, womanizer. He was 40 when he married my mom. He turned completely around, became a loving, dedicated husband, an elder in the church. It's like that's what happens in marriage. When you get married, everything is wonderful, it gets better. So I thought, well, Gene is not into me that much, and evidence of that was our wedding. He didn't want to be involved with any of the planning, but he did say he'd do the rings and the honeymoon. I said I liked antique gold. We got the rings in the mail. You could scratch the black off with your fingernail. So we sent those $65 rings back, and he found me a $7 wedding rings, which I had for years. So that was it. And then he was supposed to be in charge of the honeymoon, but he didn't do that. His cousin paid for our first night, and then after that, we spent the rest of our honeymoon with his cousin and his wife. So that was just gives you kind of the reluctance and
The lack of love,
yes, lack of love.
truly.
Yeah.
And right, I mean, already I know some women listening are thinking, whether they're part of a church community or not, you think of people going into the ministry as what are they supposed to be? They're supposed to be loving, kind, respectful, make the whole list of things,
Right.
not putting you on a pro and con list or just playing power games,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
How old were you both when you got married?
I was 22 and he was 25.
Okay.
So,
And at this point, where in the US did you settle for the beginning of your marriage?
we went back to Kentucky where he was in seminary. That was an adventuresome time. I mean, he was also an artist. We did artwork together, displayed it at different places. And just had some fun, but also that was when he started doing some very extreme teasing where he would poke at me and poke at me, find my vulnerable spots. He was very perceptive. He could tell what a person's most vulnerable spot was, and he would dig at it and dig at it to get a reaction. And it was kind of a relief for him when he saw somebody else going crazy. It was like it just, he had done that with his younger brother. He loved to tease and very harsh teasing, but very perceptive teasing where he knew what your soft spots were. So that was difficult. After seminary, we took our first short assignment at a church in the Bay Area. We lived in a Sunday school room that was used on Sunday for the high schoolers, took our showers at a neighbor's house. So we did that for the summer.
And this is the Bay Area, is in Northern
California.
California.
Yeah.
Okay. Because that's how, when I hear Bay Area, I
Yeah.
think Northern California, but I know there may be other Bay Areas in the US. So
Not in my world.
I know. I just thought I would. So my goodness, you have gone really to several different cultures and
Yes.
regions
Yeah.
in your marriage. And so, okay. So now you're in Northern California in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area there.
And then after that, we did a lot of short-term things. He tried different things and never really was satisfied with anything. We did a month, another Sunday school room in Oklahoma City. We were in Idaho. We were in different places in California, in Washington State, in Oregon. And eventually, when I got pregnant, we were living in a little trailer in Lindsay, California, and decided we'd better settle down. So we took a church in Oregon and stayed there for a year. And we actually bought a house. Finally, somebody in the church gave us a really good deal on a house. And So first child was born, and then after that year we went all over the place to Sacramento, California. And then I got pregnant again with our second son. We moved to Edmonds to a rat infested house that the church was going to be tearing down and let us use for free. And had no jobs at the time. The rats were eating my clothes, bringing a baby into this. And then we moved back to Seattle, and then we moved to Vashon Island, and that's where we stayed the longest time. We had a church there for a couple of years until it closed, and got pregnant with my third child, and was working for Western Airlines at the time, and had done some substitute teaching at different times to try to supplement our very erratic income. We never had money. It was always an adventure, but not always a fun adventure. But I learned to work with it, and I could get along with very little and learn to be happy with it. And then while we were on Vashon, I had our fourth child, which was a girl, and I had her at home. So that was quite the experience. It was, and I'd had natural childbirth with midwives with the other children, most of the children. And so it felt like we completed our family.
Sure. And I'm going to pause here for a moment in the story to just kind of figure out, okay, how old are you at this time? How old are all of the kids? And then I want to ask a little more about how you were feeling within the marriage. But let's just, we'll sort of pause for a moment at this point after your fourth child. Are you, so you're in your, are you still in your 20s?
30s.
You're in your 30s at this point. And then how old are all the kids?
There's 3 years between each one of them.
Okay. Yeah.
And
So essentially, you had a newborn about 3 years old, about 6 years old, and about 9 years old.
Yeah, thank you for helping me with
Yeah.
that.
I mean,
Math is not my thing.
birthdays, get shuffled all in there. So that is a very full and big family.
Yes.
And as you've described this so far, I mean, you're under all kinds of financial stress, which usually is not helpful to a
No,
marriage.
never.
And having a big family, I mean, there's a lot, I mean, children are the greatest blessing in the world. It's also a challenge,
Yes.
and that's hard. And so, as you're describing being in this marriage with somebody who has not been kind to you, people always ask, "Well, why don't you just leave? Why did you stay?" I mean, the outsider looking in who hasn't experienced this, they have a very simplistic view of it. But usually, men like that have plenty of qualities that draw you in. And that everyone, I mean, did other people just think he was the most amazing pastor in the world,
No,
or were they
thank
seeing?
goodness. Oh, I'm so thankful for that. They talk about a house devil and a street angel, but he was equal opportunity abuser. So that really helped. And the church people were always very supportive of me and very empathetic with me, because he was very controlling and harsh with other people too. But he was funny, so he would couch it in, well, I'm just teasing. But he knew how to get right to your very soft spot and poke it and poke it. And so yeah, we Vashon was a good experience for the most part, and the kids felt like we had goats and milk goats and chickens, and it was a pretty good experience for us. But then we opened a gallery there and had an antique shop, and we both did painting, and but we just couldn't make it. And he got an opportunity to take an interim pastorate in Tumwater, so we moved there, and we're there for a year. And I found out I was pregnant fifth time, and I was like, oh no. We were trying natural birth control, and that's what you call parents, is people who try natural birth control. But with each of my pregnancies, I would pray, and I would get this deep sense of everything's good, just a gut level, it's good. And when I prayed with this one, it was like, this is different. And we were going to have him at home. At this time, we'd moved to Kirkland to start a church in a bingo hall.
Okay, and now where is Kirkland?
Washington.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But I was having really different experience this time, and there was just something different, and I felt this very clear sense that I couldn't have this baby at home. This one was going to be different. It was dangerous to have him at home. And when I told Gene that, he said, God does not talk to you. You do what I tell you to do, and we're not going to go to the hospital. We don't have the money. And the church people rallied around me, supported me, took me to the doctor's appointments in the hospital, the midwife appointments in the hospital, and all the different tests I had to do. I had gestational diabetes and some crazy high blood pressure symptoms that they couldn't figure out. But Jean just kind of cut off from all of that when I couldn't deliver at home. And so when I went in for delivery, I had four friends with me, and he refused to come to the hospital and changed his mind after a day and a half and came in about a half an hour before I went into the delivery room. And in the delivery room, I had an experience of what I don't remember much about it, but my friend who was there said I curled into a tight ball and started to shake, and the whole room filled with doctors and technicians. They gave me magnesium sulfate to lower my blood pressure, and then my muscles are like mush. I couldn't do anything, but we delivered Joshua. He was 9 pounds, 6 ounces. You know, I thought, oh, he's healthy, he's big, and he was beautiful, but he was very quiet and was blue. And so they whisked him away, did my repair work, and then the doctor came in and said, we suspect some heart defects. We're not sure, so we're going to have to take him to Children's Hospital, and but we'll bring him by to tell him, so you can tell him goodbye. And, you know, it's like I didn't get to bond with him. I didn't get to touch him. He was pulled away from me. He became their baby, not mine. And a very strong person, as it goes, with bonding with each of my children, you know, I would hold them immediately and, you know, do all those things you're supposed to do to bond with your baby and nurse them for years. And but it was like he was a stranger. I didn't know how to interact with him, and they brought him by, and he was just very quiet with his little arms folded over his chest. And they said, we'll call you when we know more, but we suspect heart issues and multiple things could be wrong with him. So during the middle of the night, Jean stayed with me in the hospital room and just trying to think of all the different scenarios. And during my pregnancy, I thought a lot about issues with, what do you do with a baby that is critically ill? How much intervention do you do? And it was during the time when they did a baboon heart transplant with baby Faye.
And for anybody who didn't know about that, can you explain baby Faye?
Yeah, she had hypoplastic left heart. Part of her heart was missing, and she wasn't able to live with that condition. So they did an experimental operation where they transplanted a baboon heart in her, and it didn't work. But they thought, well, you know, they've tried so many other things, you know, with different animals, maybe this would work. Mm-hmm. And so I thought a lot about, what are the ethics of that? I mean, how do you make a decision for somebody, for a child who doesn't have any input? What's the difference between quantity and quality of life?
All the thoughts nobody ever wants to have to think about.
No, but it was just kind of in our faces because of that whole thing, and people discussing, you know, well, it advances science to do this, but then the child, the mm-hmm. baby has no choice, and that doesn't seem the right thing to do. And do you put them through all of that for what? So we did get a call in the middle of the night that Joshua had hypoplastic left heart, plus problems with his liver, spleen, diaphragm, multiple. He had just, everything was wrong. And they said he would probably live 48 hours. I was still unable to even turn over in bed. I was, because of the magnesium sulfate, I guess that was why, but I had no muscle strength. I was hallucinating. I hadn't slept for days. I would shut my eyes, see images, open my eyes, see the same images floating around me. And I was just overwhelmed and devastated. And it's like, okay, I've got to put that baby out of my mind and just try to deal with the onslaught of all that was happening to me physically, and all the relational pain that had gone on, feeling abandoned by Gene, and then here he was, now he's involved and wanting to take over and had all his ideas. So in the morning, my midwife Terry came in and said, "We're going to bring Joshua over here and get you two together and bond before he dies." And I said, "You know what? I'm okay. Let's just let it be." And that is just so not like me. But it was like, I can't handle anything else. And she said, "You will never regret the time that you spent, but you will always regret the time you didn't spend." So she was very strong-willed, and she said, "We're going to get you together. It doesn't matter." And it was at a time when you weren't supposed to unhook people from life support. She says, "But I went over and I talked to Children's very strongly, said he's not going to make it. He's not. These people don't have insurance, so they can't even afford to have you do experiments with this baby. You need to unhook him, give him to us, and we'll take him back to his mom." They put him in and put him on a respirator to get him across town to where I was in the hospital where I was in Seattle. They brought him in, and he did not look like the baby I entrusted to them. He had bruises from the needles and had his lips were all chapped from the oxygen and just little red marks on his face. He was all puffy and just, it's like. And I didn't know what to do with him. I couldn't even hold him, but they put him next to me, and there were a lot of people, and the kids came to see him, and everybody was talking. And then finally, when they left, Terry said, and I should know this, but she says, "Talk to him, just talk to him and tell him everything you need to tell him. And don't leave anything unsaid, no unfinished business." And it's like, I know that, but she had to tell me.
What an amazing midwife.
Yes, she really was. She was very strong and knew what she was doing. So I talked to him and I said, "We named you after my dad, whose name was Josh, and I'm going to be here with you like he was next to me when I was sick. And I will take care of you until you're safe in the arms of Jesus. And I will keep talking to you and loving you and telling." And then I just told him about my reticence to have him over and why, and just confessed my confusion. And then I got really tired and I stopped talking, and he started gasping for air. And it's like, oh no. And so I started talking to him again, and then he calmed down, and I'd stop and he would start gasping. And it's like, oh, I can do something for him.
Voice.
My voice. He knew my voice. He knew me. In the middle of the night, or towards early morning, I tried to nurse him, and he actually nursed and he opened his eyes, and I saw his eyes we for the first time. And it's like, oh, this could work. And our nurse came in, Bonnie, who was just so amazingly supportive. And there's some people that avoid pain, and there's other people that just are there. And she was there, and she encourages. She said, "We can take out his IV. You can take him home." So they were a little reticent, but they said, "You can do that." And then we talked about kind of our plan and what to do when he died. And we weren't sure he'd make it across town from Seattle to Kirkland, Washington. So they talked about, well, when he does die, you need to get him to Children's Hospital because we decided to donate his eyes for a cornea transplant. We wanted his life to count. It counted anyway, but it was like, we want another child to see because of him. His middle name was Aaron, which means bringer of light. So we had that. We knew what we were supposed to do. We got him home. It was Christmas time.
I should have brought tissues.
You're so sweet. It was Christmas time. We brought him home to the kids, giving him presents. They had found things in the basement. They wrapped them up in weird packaging, and neighbors came by. Everybody was touching him and loving him. And it was just amazing to have him home, and it was so helpful for our kids to be able to see him in the normality of home rather than hooked up to a machine at Children's where they saw him first, or even in my hospital room. It was just too much. And we decided that we wanted to just do normal things with him. So we took him to church and had him dedicated. And that just felt like what you would do with a new baby. Everybody was so sweet and supportive. On Christmas Eve, we decided to drive to Portland to visit my parents, who had moved to Portland at that time, and my dad, who was 86 and dying from a stroke. We wanted him to meet his namesake. So we went down, and it was just very poignant to see them both there on the edge of eternity. And I always thought, I expected to lose my father and my history, but not to lose my child and the future. That was hard. But the next day, Jean began a search for a neonatal cardiologist in Portland. So we ended up at OSHU with a well-known cardiologist who did a electrocardiogram and explained extensive damage and that there was just no real hope. And to subject him to an operation would have been to have him spend his time in an intensive care unit. And she advised us, she said if it was her baby, she'd take him home and love him and give him the best life possible, no matter how short. And that made sense to us. He got weaker every day. We were into New Year's Eve by this time. We held him every day. One thing that was really sweet was I would hold him in the crook of my arm at night, and he was barely nursing. He just kept breathing. It was amazing that nobody thought he could live that long. He lived 16 days, which was, they said he couldn't live more than 2 days. And when he was in the crook of my arm, sleeping next to me one night, I thought, yeah, I'm really tired, and he's only awake for about 15 minutes. He probably doesn't even know. So I just set him in the bed right next to me. And then he just started crying and gasping. And it was like, it was worth him to expend all that energy to get back into my arm.
Yes.
So on New Year's Eve, we knew he was fading. In the middle of the night, I woke up and listened to his faint breathing, but went back to sleep. And in the morning, I looked at him and I knew he was gone. It was helpful that we had to get him to some place fast, to Children's Hospital, for his eyes to be donated, because I just would never have wanted to let go of him otherwise. And it just felt weird to come home empty arms. Very, very hard. But we had a lot of support from neighbors, from friends, from church. Everybody just surrounded us. In the days that followed, we got his body back and arranged with somebody to make a little wood coffin. A neighbor sewed a covering. Children put a small toy in the box. And the whole process was really gut-wrenching, but it felt right because we wanted to be the ones involved in taking care of our child's body instead of assigning that task to strangers. We had a funeral at the church, and it was packed. People were there to acknowledge the importance of our baby's life, and tangible love like I never had felt before lifted me up, surrounded and comforted me. The next day, we went to the cemetery on Vashon Island. The funeral director, Jean, and the boys and a couple friends dug a small grave, and we buried him. It felt normal and the right thing to do to be involved. It just eased the pain to be participators instead of spectators. We were working out our grief in practical, normal ways. And I think back about how different it would have been if my midwife had not insisted that Joshua be brought back to Bonn before he died. It would have been a whole different ball game. At the time, I was so overwhelmed with my own pain that if she had let me, I would have said I couldn't handle it. Why put yourself in painful situations? However, if you're only looking for comfort, we'll miss out on what life is all about. You stay safe and you know some surface temporary happiness, but the deep joy comes when you're open and vulnerable. Love doesn't come without risk, but there's no being whole without it. Grief is the price we paid for fully embracing and loving a dying baby, but it was worth every painful and uncertain moment.
You know, I know this story already, but even just to hear you say it, obviously, I'm a bit of an emotional mess over here. And as you were closing out this chapter, I kept thinking, how in the world am I going to transition out of this? And I thought, well, the whole point of Story Night is to be real. And
Thank you.
so, listeners, I do not know how to transition out of this. This is just as raw as it comes in telling a story. And I know you're describing a chapter that's, I mean, how many years has that been since this?
It was 1984, so it's been a long time.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
mean, we're talking 40-ish years.
You're the math girl.
And I can't imagine anyone listening who doesn't have tears in their eyes right now either. So I have to apologize, listeners. We are going to pause here and pick up Nancy's story with a part two. So
It gets better.
yeah, so there is a lot of hope and redemption and a
Yes.
lot of beauty that's coming in part two. So come back, hang with us. And I want to thank you so much for being willing to share this. I mean, some of the stories that we hear are truly just unimaginable. They have suffering in them that many of us have never experienced, and we cannot fathom it. And in my opinion, that you have one of those stories. I think for many women listening, they can't think of much worse than losing a child. You wrote a book.
It's more like a booklet,
As much, it's,
but
yes.
I finally did that a few years ago because I was involved with a baby who had hypoplastic left heart with the parents, and she was in the hospital for a couple years, and I just thought, I think it's time to write the story. So I did that and I self-published. It's on Amazon. It's called Embracing Joshua, Life and Death Lessons. And very short, but I just felt like if it helps one person, and it has helped some people that have found it and talked to me. So
Yeah.
I just want anything I do to be redemptive because that's, redemption is the
Amen.
thing. Yes.
And I know you have the peace that Joshua's in heaven
Yes.
with your dad, Joshua, the two Joshuas, right?
And my mom and my sister
Yeah,
and
a family reunion up there waiting for the rest of the family members when it's their turn. So we will come back. We will record the rest of your story. And listeners, come back and tune in for that. You won't want to miss it. Ladies, I do want to encourage you that no matter how dark of a chapter you might be living through right now, that there is hope, there is encouragement. And that's part of why we have this outreach. We want women to know that you have a story and your story matters. And that no matter what you go through, you are not alone. If you feel alone, we want to help you find that community of support. You mentioned some of the support that came around you
Yes,
during
huge.
your marriage, during the loss of your child,
Yes.
and so many other things. And so for those who are maybe listening to this, who are new to the whole Story Night outreach, let me take a quick minute and tell you that in addition to this podcast, we have four live events per year. And these are incredible evenings for women all over the community to come together, build relationships, meet new friends, connect, hear a woman tell her amazing story, have some food. Sometimes we'll have somebody perform a song. And it's just meant to be a beautiful night. And our next one is coming up on October 2nd. It's going to be at the Grand Ballroom, downtown McMinnville. The doors will open at 6:30, so you have time to just arrive, mingle, have something to snack on, and connect. And then at 7 o'clock, we will start with the story. Now, normally, with our live events, we record them. And so if you miss them, you can watch the live event on our YouTube channel or hear the audio recording on this podcast. However, this time we will not be recording the story because it's a very sensitive topic. Our speaker is a survivor of sexual and domestic violence, and we just really want to protect her and her family. We don't want you to miss this story, though. It's a very powerful story, and we would love to have you there. Over 200 women have already signed up. We have maybe 30 to 40 tickets left, so don't delay. Jump on our website, storynighthope.com, to get your free ticket and invite all the women in your life. We would love to have you there, and you can meet Nancy in person. She'll be there, as well as most of the women who have been on this podcast as well. If you happen to be listening to this episode after October 2nd, 2025, you can still go on our website to find out which live event we have coming up next and get your ticket for that one. So Nancy, thank you for being part of the Story Night family. Thank you for being willing to do this. I look forward to getting the rest of your story out to our listeners. And I do want to take a moment and thank our state representative, Lucetta Elmer. She is the one who is providing the platform for this season of Story Night. She was a Story Night speaker herself and just truly believes in the power of stories. So we thank you so much, Representative Elmer, for this. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in.
Thank you for honoring women's stories and for all that you do. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. I really appreciate you so much. Ladies, well, I hope you were blessed. I hope you were encouraged, and I promise there is more encouragement to come. I hope you come back next time to hear the next story. And until then, remember, you have a story, your story matters, and you are not alone.